All right. Hello, how are you doing today? Doing all right? All right. Well, today we'll be talking about testing your C# based Windows Store apps. And my name is Francis Cheung. I work for the Patterns and Practices Group at Microsoft. And first question to you folks, how many of you have apps in the Windows Store? Two, three, four. Wow, any more than I hope. That's awesome. How are your ratings? Just got released, okay. Any other people who want to confess about the ratings? Are you happy with your ratings? You're happy?
I work for Vector Forum. We have a couple of different offices. We released an app called Toolbox. We had
I've used your app. I like it.
We had over 500,000 downloads, and I think we're holding 4.5-star rating right now.
Okay, so 4.5-star, that's great. Anybody else? Okay. Anybody not so happy with the ratings? Nobody wants to admit it. Okay. Well, anyway, the ratings I find to be directly relevant or directly correlated to the quality of your app. Oftentimes, it's not necessarily that your app throws exceptions or what, but it may have to do with what people's perception was of the app. People may perceive that your app should be doing one thing and your app doesn't, or it doesn't respond in the normal usage patterns that you'd expect. So hopefully I'll provide some guidance to help you bring up the numbers. If you're happy with it, that's great. But hopefully this will help you get even better rating scores. All right? So hopefully that'll be of value to you. The agenda will be some background first. I'll give you some background as to how I acquired the knowledge I'll be giving you today. I'll be giving you some top problem areas that came from that background. Be giving some demos, and I'll be doing some Q&A. The Q&A will happen throughout the whole time. I'll be asking for questions. And then we'll have some Q&A time at the very end of the talk, right? The background. Now, my team at Patterns and Practices wrote a Windows Store app called AdventureWorks Shopper. Now, this Shopper app is a pretty standard Shopper app that you'd think you'd write, right? It allows you to navigate through a hierarchy of products, allows you to search for them, allows you to put those products into a shopping cart, allows you to check out that shopping cart, lets you authenticate, typical shopping cart type stuff. Also, it's a Windows Store app, so you expect it to be able to handle suspension and resumption, search integration, secondary tile support. So this really was an attempt to really hit that market the way I think you guys would have. Okay. One thing it also does is it does forms over data. So if you have billion shipping type forms you need to enter and need to be able to validate that form, we handle that too. Right. So we wrote the app, we tested it. Our crack test team spent a lot of time to thoroughly test this app in terms of performance, in terms of accessibility, in terms of a lot of different angles. And we tested it, fixed the bugs. I think I personally fixed about half the bugs. And then we harvested the learnings. Harvesting the learnings into the documentation as well as talks like this. So hopefully I'll give you a lot of that detail. Also, we harvested the reusable code from that app. Now, this is typically how we do things at Patterns and Practices. We write the app and say that, you know what, this piece here is so usable. We see people using this all over the place, so we go ahead and put that into a common library. In this case, we created Prism for Windows Runtime, as one of our attendees has mentioned before. And this is nothing related to the government surveillance program, none whatsoever. Trust me, nothing related. Okay? So that's Prism. If you have any questions about Prism, I'm free to talk about that downstairs in the great room. And shoot me an email if you have any questions. All right? So here are the top 10 problem areas that we found when we wrote the app. I'll cover everything here from suspend, resume, all the way down to the UX guidelines. This will basically be our detailed agenda for the talk. Right? Let's start with suspend, resume. Now, suspend, resume, and terminate launch is a very standard thing within Windows Store apps. You need to be able to provide this behavior. Right? It's very simple. When you swipe away from your app, that does a suspend. And that's an opportunity for you to stash away any state that you may have acquired from the user. If the user selected certain things on the screen, you need to be able to maintain that state if the app gets terminated, right? You don't know if the app will get terminated. There will be no event that termination occurred. You will know that suspend occurred, however. So testing suspension is very simple. All you have to do is swipe away, and the app gets suspended. If you want to come back, if you swipe back, that does a resume. Testing termination is a little bit harder. If you just run your app, termination happens when you have memory pressure. So if you've got enough memory pressure, your app will terminate. The easiest way to test it, really, is to use the Visual Studio Debugger and select suspend and shut down. That will simulate a terminate and relaunch. Now, if you just go ahead and Alt F4 or swipe down and close your app, that's different. That's actually closing the app. That does not do a terminate. So when you launch the app again, you get a new app instance. And so you don't have the expectation that your user interface got persisted. But if you do a suspend and shut down, the expectation is that when the user relaunches your app, you get the same experience. Okay? So that's terminate shutdown. Now, the important thing here is to test that your app performs the expected behavior. The expected behavior is that you really get what you came back, that you really get where you left from. If you had certain data on the screen and you suspend or terminate, you should be able to see that data when you come back. Now, the only variation to that is that, let's say if you, and this is really a choice for your specific app. Let's say that you suspended or terminated, and it's been a couple hours, and you come back to your app. Well, your sensor data might be old, your server data might be old. It's kind of up to you how you want to present that data back to the user. You may want to re-query the server, re-query your sensors, and give that user back to the data, get that data back to your users. But again, you don't want it to be jarring. You don't want it to be really strange and they came back to something that was really strange to them, right? So here, the guidance here is to go and run your app, and on every page of your app and on every stage of your app, for example, you're on a master details type page, you selected a row on a grid and you've got some details and you've changed the UI a little bit, if they suspend or terminate and come back, you'd expect that to be the way they left it, right? Another thing to do here, which is not quite exactly suspend, resume, terminate, relaunch, is just navigation. Let's say that the user, or you had a page with a wide grid view, right? User panned and panned and panned and panned, selected an item. So they navigate forward. When they hit the back button, what do they see? Do you start off way over the right? Or do you maintain the user's context? So it's really important to be able to store that scroll position when the user just navigates. This is tangential to suspend resume, but it's also related. Whenever you leave that screen, you need to be able to store that data. All right, any questions about this so far? Let me give you a quick demo. All right, so I've got an app here. If I go ahead and run it, and I go ahead and get some data. So I get the current date time, put that on screen. If I go back here and hit suspend and resume, come back, no big deal, it's the same app. If I go ahead and suspend and shut down, this forces the terminate event, or forces my app to terminate. When I relaunch the app, oh, my data's gone. That's not good. All right, the fix for that, of course, in this case, since I'm using a pretty out-of-the-box project, if I go in my project, if I go in my main page here, code behind, this is a layout-aware page. So the fix to this is to make sure to use the save state and load state methods that are provided for you. So in this case, I am taking the state of the text box and putting it into my page state, and conversely, loading my text box with the page state when I come back. Okay. So this is all using the layout aware page and suspension manager that are all pre-hooked up. Got a question here? So the question is there an API that can simulate the suspend and resume outside of Visual Studio? I don't know of one that does. I don't know of one that does. But I can find out for you. I can.
The background is that, you know, you can do this manually as much as you want, but at the end of the day, you want to automate it. As you get involved,
great, great question. So the question is, how do you automate this? The suspend resume process. I'm not sure. Let me ask my test team, and I'll get back to you. If you can send me an email, I'll follow up and get that answer back to you. Okay. All right. So you can see here, you need to be able to test suspend resume on every state. Here, let me go and navigate to the next page. Okay. And I'm going to suspend my app now that I've navigated forward. And oh, I got a nasty exception. Yuck. So in this case, the suspension manager was not happy. Suspension manager wasn't happy because it's trying to serialize the frame state, the frames stack. And so if we go back to my main page here, you'll see that when I navigate forward, using the frame, I'm navigating to the customer page, and I'm passing it a customer instance. This works fine when you run the app. When I run the app, I arrive at the customer page, and the customer page receives a customer object, an instance of the customer object. However, when I suspend, this blows up. It's because the frame doesn't know how to serialize the customer object. So what I recommend is instead of using object instances or non-primitives, go ahead and pass IDs around. Go ahead and pass primitives using the frames navigate. If you use anything other than primitives, you're going to have problems with suspension. Right? Any questions about that? All right. I'll take that as a no. Sorry, I got a question here? The question is, if I mark the class as serializable, will that work? I'm not sure. The guidance in the API of the frame is to definitely not use anything other than primitives. So it may or may not work. Hard to say. But given the API docs clearly state don't use anything other than primitives, it may work now, may not work in the future. I'm not sure. But basically, the API right now says to use primitives. Right? All right, so next topic is client updates. We talked in the keynote about the new feature of Windows in that you don't have to go and manually update your apps. You don't have to go and pick the apps that you want and update them. They'll automatically get updated. This causes this problem to be even worse. The issue is really around data versioning, right? So let's say you've got version one of your app, and somebody starts using it. You start using your version one of your app, and then it's starting to write all these data to temp files on your local file system, right? You have version two of your app. If you've got version one of your data, and your version two of your app doesn't know what to do with version one data, and it loads up these data files, what's going to happen? It may not be very happy with that. So the guidance here for testing is to copy off, go ahead and run your app in all these different versions, copy off data pertaining to each version. So you've got three versions of your app. You've got version 1, 2, and 3 of your data. Copy it off. When you have version 4 of your app, test to see how your version 4 deals with version 1, 2, 3 of your data. Does it detect the versions and correspondingly deal with the data, right? If you don't, you'll get exceptions. This is one killer issue that I've seen across different platforms. Seen this on iOS and Android. If you don't take the time to version your data, you're going to have some problems. So let's go and give you a demo on that. All right, so I run the app. Here I'm going to save some data to my local folder. Here you can see a serialized customer object. In this case, the name is Francis, and it's in JSON format. And when I go ahead and get the data, I'm actually getting the name attribute of the customer. You can see the name is Francis, so that works fine. So the data is now saved onto my local machine, into the local folder. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to simply change the customer to not have a string for the ID. I'm going to make that an int. Right? And back here, I'll just make sure that this doesn't complain anymore. I run my app, and what should happen? Any guesses? Anybody? Yeah, it's not very happy, right? This is version one of the data. Version two of the app is trying to load that version one. Not happening. So this is a very common thing. So definitely copy off the previous versions of your data and see how your app responds to that, right? Any questions about client updates? Okay, pretty straightforward. Network connectivity. At a bare minimum, your app needs to deal with no connectivity. That's pretty easy to test, right? Unplug, disconnect from your wired network, however, whichever one you have, and then see how your app responds, right? It should at least, at a bare minimum, do some exception management, right? Some exception handling. So maybe log it and so forth. But your app shouldn't die. Your app should at least respond appropriately to no connectivity. But what do you do to simulate slow connectivity, right? Now, it's easy if you're connecting to a local host in your test environment, but realistically, you're going to be hitting a live service. You don't know what kind of SLA you're going to have with that service. It may be slow sometimes. How do you test that? And the answer that my team has come up with is to use Fiddler. Anybody use Fiddler? For that, I've got a good third of the audience. You guys are rock stars. You guys are great. That's great. So Fiddler is fantastic for testing slow connectivity. So for the rest of you guys, it looks like maybe half, maybe, that haven't seen this functionality, I'll show it to you right now. All right, so I go and run my app, and I'll go ahead and test my network connectivity. So this is a little bit slow because I'm running the service for the first time. It's going to go ahead and get some data, and come on, you can do it. It's got to warm up the service. Oh, there we go. Okay, so when I run it now, it responds. You know what? I think I've got. That's why. Let's sing a song. Shoot, I gave up my demo. Shoot, sorry about that. Anyway, here I am. I get some data, it comes back. That's great, it works great. But I'm hitting my local environment, right? That's no test. It's supposed to work fast. So now, how do I make it look slow? Well, I just open up Fiddler. And what I've got here, if I go ahead and kill all the previous requests and make another request. Great. You can see that Fiddler captured that. And I'm using the autoresponder feature to detect, hey, if I see a request coming through that looks like this, and it happened to look like that, I'm going to respond with a 200. And I'm going to wait 5 seconds for that. Right? So all I have to do is turn my autoresponses on, and without having to change a lick code in my app, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So you can see Fiddler is great for doing that. But not, in addition to just delaying it, I can say, you know what, instead of returning a 200, I want to return 502, 401, anything you want, right? Anything you want. So about a third of you already knew about that. How about the rest? Is this valuable to you? Yeah, definitely a powerful tool to have in your tool bag. All right. So that was network connectivity. Okay, meter connections. Let's go back to the demo. So before I go back there, meter connections. A lot of your customers, you don't know which ones, but a lot of your customers are going to have meter connections. Right? They're going to be paying for every bit that goes across the wire. And how do you deal with that? Well, there are APIs to detect if you have a meter connection. That's fine. But how do you test how your app deals with that? Well, it's pretty easy. The OS provides this out of the box. So let me show you that. Okay, if I go down to my network here, you can see, you can see I'm connected to this Wi-Fi network. If I right-click on it, set as meter connection, so that's going to do something interesting. When you set your meter connection, it's going to change your behavior of your box number one. So, for example, any updates that you would have downloaded automatically if you were on a non-meter connection, those won't happen in the meter connections. So it just changes the behavior. But now that I'm on a metered connection, I can show the estimated data usage. I can reset that, run my app again, and I can see how much is actually going over the wire. Right? That's pretty useful. Anybody use this before? No? All right. More value. That's price of admission right there. Okay, meter connections. Any questions about meter connections? Got a question?
Question about the disconnect. Yes, on your development platform, you can disconnect to check your app as you're running it locally. Or what if you're running like a service trace viewer or some of the new asynchronous views and you want to see what happens when a server doesn't have the message back and forth?
Okay, so the question was about asynchronous calls and if you want to simply not just disconnect your client box.
Right.
I think you'd still use Fiddler for that. So I'm not talking about using a tablet to test. If you've got a laptop that you can run Fiddler, it'll intercept all those calls. So any calls to that domain or however you want to configure it, it'll intercept all those calls, right? Yeah. So any more questions about network connectivity and metered? No? Right. Asynchronous code. So for some general guidance before I launch into my asynchronous code and cancellation is to go ahead and take a look at Stephen Tobe's talk, Asyncing Your Way to a Successful App with .NET. To me, he is the guru of asynchronous code. So definitely attend his talk for some great general guidance on asynchronous development. Async and await are great, and he'll definitely show you some ways to use that correctly. All right? So moving on to asynchronous code. It's great. It's easy to use. You can just use async and await everywhere, and everything's great, right? Everything's perfect. No problems, right? No. Well, over and above what you'll see in Stephen Tobe's talk are some of the issues that I'll be talking about right now. First thing you'll want to do is run your app and see if there's specific pages that take a long time to load. Right? Those are going to take heavy asynchronous operations, and you may want to see how your app is using that. For example, if there's a specific page that takes a long time to load, navigate to the page, hit the back, navigate to it again, hit back, you know, do it several times, and see how your app responds. Is your app performing multiple requests and processing that data multiple times? If it is, you're chewing up valuable resources. In addition to battery, you're chewing up your network resources potentially. So these things are all things you need to take in consideration. Now, if you are doing these multiple things, you may want to consider a couple options. One option is cancellation, right? You have the ability, since these are tasks that you typically return when you do an async operation, you can cancel the task. Now, if you don't cancel the task, you could do other things. For example, you could cache the data, right? So let's say the first time you actually hit the data source, you could go ahead and cache it. In that case, since you're caching, you may actually want it to let it finish, right? First time you hit it, you may not want to cancel it. You might want to just go ahead and let it finish. But if you do want to cancel it, then you wouldn't necessarily need caching, right? Next thing, anybody runs this problem where they've got a page where they hit the submit button and you hit it again and you get an exception, right? Right. That's very typical. You run into this in the web world a lot. The issue here is that you haven't disabled the button, right? So you allow the user to submit a form multiple times. That may wreak havoc. And one option, of course, is to simply disable the button once the user has started the operation so that you can have the async operation finish, in which case you can re-enable the button and so forth. Another option is to control the order of which that happens. For example, if the user were to just hammer on that submit button, you may want to say, well, okay, I saw that you hammered on it 3 times. Maybe you really want to submit it 3 times, that's fine, but I'm going to go ahead and control the order of that. And let's say if the user hit the back button, I may want to cancel all the ones that hadn't finished. Okay, so that's something you might want to consider. But yeah, hammering on those buttons often gives you interesting results. Right? Now, let's say that you're in that latter case where you don't disable the buttons. You allow the user to go in and hammer on the buttons. You allow them to perform multiple async operations. If you allow them to do this on a shared or common data set, like CRUD operations on, let's say, a customer data set, you may get some interesting interleaving issues. Okay, for example, if you were to go and update, then delete. Update, delete, update, delete, update, delete. Well, what happens if the delete finishes before the update? Right? It's asynchronous, so you don't know when it finishes. You can wait for it, but if you start it off and you allow somebody else to start something else, well, you've basically started 2 asynchronous tasks. You don't know when they finish, so you can continue. So this is where the async interleaving may cause you some problems. And unfortunately, these are problems that don't show up easily, because if you hit update, then delete, well, the update probably finished. So chances are you have to be quick about this in order to have these problems occur or for these problems to surface, right? So one thing that works for me that worked in our project is to add some delays just to make it a little more realistic, right? So these async operations may complete very, very quickly on my local box because I'm hitting a local host or so or local in-memory database because I don't want to hit my production database. But in reality, it's going to take a lot longer. So I'm just going to simulate that, and I simulate that with the code in red. So this is not necessarily production code. This is code that you could add at just test time just to see how your code works. But you could check this in, you know, and it'll only execute when you're debugging. But what this does is it puts in a random delay. In this case, it's a random delay of 500 milliseconds, half a second, or 2 seconds. So this is important because, as you can see here, this is get operation. We'll have a random delay. I'll also put this random delay in the update, the delete, and all the other CRUD operations just to see, hey, if I go and play around with this, if I use the app and I hit these different CRUD operations, do they conflict? Am I going to get some problems? Right? So this is the inject code method into your code base. I'm not a huge fan of it, but if you are, for example, hitting a local data store, this is all you can do. Right? You have to put some delays in order to see some of the weird problems. So this is what you can do. If, let's say, that you're hitting a service for this, Fiddler, again, is your answer. Fiddler, you can program to say, hey, when I get a call to this address, let me delay a random amount. So Fiddler is a great option for this. So let me give you a demonstration of async interleaving and how it can be problematic. All right, so let's say I get some data from my cache. Right, that looks great. And then I update the data, and it clears the cache. And it clears that data. I get updated, so you can see the timestamp change. Update it, clears it. Get, update, get, update, get, update. So that seems to work fine, right? But of course, I'm hitting a local data source, and so I expect it to work fine. It's going to be really quick, and the async operation is going to finish before I hit the next button. But what if it doesn't? If I were to go down here to my service, I can put some constant delays, right? I can delay a specific amount of time. So then when I hit the get and the update, well, it's just going to take longer, but chances are it's going to still finish in the exact same order. So what you want to do is you want to vary the order. So what I'll do here is instead of putting in my constant delay, I'm going to go and put in a random delay for both the get and the update, run the app, and see if I can get it to behave strangely. So I'll do the get, which will get to the data. You can see the random update. Then I'll do the update. Sorry. The get performs the get operation, and we've got the random delay. Then I'll do the update, which does a random delay and the clearing. So get, update. OK, that worked fine. OK. Oop. Let's try one more time. All right, so just by trying this three times, you see that the update operation finished before the get. So now my get happened, but I finished my update before, so this is old data. So now I'm caching old data. This is not showing the data that I was updating, and that's a problem. Okay? So this is just an example of the problems you could run into with async interleaving. So the solution to this is to, when you look at the code base, I'm doing a get and I'm doing an update, but they're completely independent of each other. Right? This is what we would consider not async safe. So the get operation does a get, but I'm not waiting for the update, I'm just doing a get. So one solution would be to wait for other operations that may pertain to what I'm doing. So if I'm doing the get, hey, I want to make sure all my delete and my updates are done before my get. If I'm doing an update, I might want to wait for everything else to be done or other updates before I do another update, right? So those are things that you may want to consider when you fix this problem. But if you put in those random delays, you may be able to surface these problems. But if I didn't put in these delays, chances are the async operations will finish before you have a chance to see the problem. All right? Got a question, yes.
And who's putting those delays? Is it your test team or is it the development team?
Great question. Great question. So the question is, who's putting in these delays? Well, I asked the question before, how many here are testers? Okay. How many people are developers and testers? Well, in this case, it's really a test function. If I'm wearing my test hat, I want to find out these problems. And if my test team is saying, hey, Francis, look, there's a problem here. I guarantee you there's a problem. And I can sit here for half an hour, and I can demonstrate it for you. And I may be able to get it to demonstrate once, but there's a problem. And all I have to do is put in this delay, and I can get it to reproduce in 5 minutes. Right? I remember sitting here with a specific async bug, and we would hammer on it for 20 minutes to get it to reproduce. And when it reproduced, it was terrible. Like, oh, it just crashed and burned. But it only happened every 20 minutes, and I had to hammer on it. Well, with these async delays, you can get it to happen really quickly. So yes, I would say it's really a testing function, but I'm not sure if I would leave these delays in the production code. But it's probably a good way of surfacing these problems. Right? Does that answer your question? All right. Resolutions and orientations, right? This is standard stuff. Basically, you want to make sure your app works on a variety of resolutions and orientations, right? This is all motherhood and apple pie, but it's surprising the apps in the Windows Store that don't follow this basic guidance. And it's really simple. Just use the simulator, vary your orientations. You can see here you can rotate them, so you can go from portrait, landscape, and so forth. And with the Windows 8.1, you have even more that you need to test with. And if your app doesn't respond to these various orientations and resolutions, it's going to look like junk. And your users are not going to be very happy. So definitely test this. It's pretty straightforward to do. Just use the simulator, right? Device testing. Now, of course, you'll test it on the local machine. Make sure it works locally. But again, use the simulator. See how it works in that environment. ARMs. ARM machines are very standard, becoming more and more popular. Surface machines are very popular. So definitely test on an ARM device. 36-bit versus 64. You need to make sure that you test it on both. You don't know what your customers are going to have. You want to be able to test it on everything they'll have. All right? Localizability. Right. I'm not talking about localization. I'm talking about localizability. Localization, to me, is a process of taking your app, your resource files, and translating them to however languages and locales that you want to support. Right. In the dev experience, you want to make sure that your app is as localizable as possible. Right. And how do you test that? Right. How do you test that before your loc team comes in and translates everything? Well, that may be too late. You'll have to have them engage multiple times before you finish your app and fix all the loc problems. The solution is to use a process called pseudo-localization. Pseudo-loc your app and then see how it responds. And it'll really surface a lot of your problems before you get to the stage where you have to send your app off to your loc team. You want to do that as much as possible in the beginning, right? And the tool that we use for that is the Multilingual App Toolkit. It'll help generate your pseudo-loc translations. And all you have to do is change your language on your box to be your pseudo-loc language, and then it'll show up. All right? Anybody use this tool before? One? Okay. Well, anybody writing apps for different cultures and languages? Okay. So a lot more. So you guys definitely want to use this. Definitely want to use this. That's definitely one of the features of Windows Store. The multi-language support is great, so you want to definitely use this. So let's go ahead and give you a demonstration of how this works. First, in my dev environment, let's go ahead and look at the project here. Under strings, ENUS, I've got a resources folder. Hey, look, I'm done, right? Got a couple of resources, I'm happy. Not quite. But I'm not sure. I can't tell from this if I just run my app. Hey, it looks great. It's in English. I read English. I'm done. That's not the case. So if I go ahead and turn on the Multilingual App Toolkit, one thing you'll notice is that it creates this folder called Multilingual Resources, and it drops in a PLOC file for you. PLOC meaning pseudo-loc. And let's go ahead and open up that file. See, I keep forgetting this. Every time I go through this, I keep forgetting. I have to build the app after I turn on the Multilingual Toolkit. Now when I open up the XLF file, I can see my two resources. But right now, my source and my translated are exactly the same, right? I'm just going to use the translation feature here to translate all of them. And bingo, I've got a pseudo-loc version of my English strings. This does a couple things. It maintains the text such that I can still read it, right? I can still run my app. If this were translated in French, I don't speak French, so I can't run my app. So I'll get lost, I'll have problems. The pseudo-loc version, still you can see the English in the text, so you can still get through your app. Another thing it does is it puts in special characters, so you can see how your app deals with those special characters. Third thing it does is it increases the length of your strings. Anybody speak German here? Okay, a couple German speakers, right? German strings are a lot longer than English strings in general. Is that correct?
Yeah, but long versus French.
Okay, so French strings may be even longer. So yeah, this is an attempt to increase your strings to see how your app deals with it. Not sure what language you may be finally deploying to or really targeting, but this is definitely something you want to do, right? Go and stretch those strings and see how that works. So in order to really test this, I'll go and save this, right? So now I've got a pseudo-look version of my app. But in order to see the pseudo-look version of my app running, not the English version, I have to add the pseudo-look language. So we'll go ahead and add language. And I want to add, so you can see here I've got US English, but I want to add the pseudo-look language. How do I do that? Well, I can hit add language here, and I can search here all day long under English, under pseudo-look. You're not going to find it. Here you have to go and put in QPS-PLOC. Right? That is a magic string you have to type in there, and all of a sudden you see an English pseudo-look version that you can add. I'll take that, move it up, and run my app. And I'll see how well my app has been pseudo-localized. And you can see, hey, I've got a couple strings that have been translated, but not many. So I still have a lot of work to do to get my app ready before I can send it off to my loc team, right? So you can see the first two strings have been localized. Those are pointing to the resource file. The rest have not. Any questions about that?
Can you repeat the string?
Excuse me?
Can you repeat the string, the magic string?
Oh, the magic string? Let me go back to my deck here. It's QPS-PLOC. So if you add a language and you type in QPS-PLOC, it will bring in the pseudo-loc version of English for you. All right? Another question.
Does that only run on the
I'm not quite following. So the question is, do you have to add the PLOC, the multilingual toolkit, on a remote device? I believe that all you have to do is add the remote language to your remote device, because as long as you compile and deploy your application to that remote, it should be able to respond to whatever language you have set up. In this case, you've basically added the PLOC language, just as you would have another language, another real language. And as long as that remote machine has that language installed, it should work fine, right? Any other questions about that? Got a question here.
This tool, I'm guessing, works fine with Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8. Does it also work well for Windows Phone 7?
So the question is, does this work for Windows Phone 7? I haven't tried it for Windows Phone 7. I haven't tried. So, sorry. A non-answer for you on that one. A multilingual app toolkit. I haven't tried it. So the question there is, does this work for apps non-Windows Store? And I haven't tried it. I've only seen the multilingual app toolkit being used within the context of Windows Store apps. So, yeah, I don't know. Sorry. But if you send me an email, I'll ask that question. Okay? Any other questions about localizability? All right. FCHEUNG. I'll show you at the very end, but it's FCHEUNG@microsoft.com. All right. Accessibility. Now, the easiest way to test accessibility in your application is to run your app, run Narrator, and close your eyes. Right? This is how a lot of people will be running your app. They'll be turning on Narrator and using your app with the spoken help of Narrator. Narrator is provided out of the box. It's actually provided as part of the OS. So this is how a great many people will be using your app through that tool. So you want to see how your tool responds to the Narrator. Does it speak everything you'd expect it to speak? Chances are no. So I would definitely use that tool and experience your app through the eyes and ears of Narrator. Right? Next thing you want to do for accessibility is to test it using high contrast. When I say high contrast, there's a light background version and a dark background version. Make sure to test both. If you've got hard-coded strings in terms of your colors, this will definitely show up. Right? If they turn on high contrast, and a lot of people will need that high contrast in order to see your app, they may not be able to see a great many things if you've got hard-coded color strings. Right? Now, let's say your favorite color is yellow, and you like to have yellow text on a gray background. Well, that may be great for you. You may like that color scheme, but it may not be able to be read by a great many people. So the WOTC Contrast Analyzer, and that is not a typo. The WOTC group is an international group, and they wrote this tool to analyze color contrast. So it'll tell you whether the color, the text color on a background is acceptable. If it gives you enough contrast, it'll tell you. So go ahead and definitely use that tool. Right? Last thing is keyboard accessibility. See how your app works with just a keyboard. Now, touchscreen and mouse work very similar, and you probably are testing that. But are you testing your app? Can you navigate through your app, get through all the paths in your app with just the keyboard? Not only the physical keyboard, but test how your app deals with your on-screen keyboard. That gives you another orientation that you may not have tested with, right? Your on-screen keyboard takes up a good chunk of your screen, and the rest of your screen may look kind of funky if you haven't tested with it, right? Let's give you a demo of the Narrator. So if you go back to my app here, I'm going to use another project here. I'll go run this project. And this may look very familiar. It is actually the out-of-the-box grid app that you get if you do file new project and you pick grid app. I modified it a little bit because the grid app does something for you that you may not even notice it does for you. But the elements that you see here, the group as well as the items, those all are items that are rendered on the screen using a grid view. And the items themselves have a base class. And the base class provides a lot of the rendering functionality. But anyway, let me turn on the Narrator.
Starting Narrator, build Fiddler, grid app window. Focus on group title button.
Okay. Window so open. If I go ahead and grid hover app. Over one of the items.
Grid app data sample data item, 3 of 5. Group okay. title enabled.
So it tells you the order, so it's 3 of 5, but it didn't really tell me what the item was, and it spoke the type name. Okay. If this happens, this is very common, this happened in our app very often. If it just simply speaks the type name, then the problem is the Narrator is looking at that and saying, hey, I see this type. I don't know anything about it, so I'm just going to call toString on it. And by default, if your type hasn't implemented a toString, it's just going to read the type. Right? So let me go and turn off.
Exit Narrator. Exiting Narrator.
If I go back to the app, I'll see that within my model here. So the sample data common is the base class for the entities that you see on the screen. If you simply go down here, you'll notice that they've provided you an implementation of toString. In this case, it returns the title of the entity. You can change it to whatever you want. If your entity has a name, serial number, whatever, you can go ahead and put that in the toString, and the narrator will call toString on it. So if I run this now, turn on narrator.
Running programs. Build demo. Running. Micro. Running. Grid app window. Grouped
so
items.
So now when I hover over the same
title,
item.
Item title. 3 of 5.
Okay.
Window
that's
opened.
That's more like
grid
it.
App.
Now it's reading what I expect. If I go ahead and hover over the group.
Group title. 1. Group. Item title. Group title. 2. Group.
Okay. So this is what I expect. And if you didn't know that, if you just go ahead and did follow your project, it overwrote the toString, and you probably wondered, why is it overwriting the toString? This is for this specific reason, for narrator support, right? Any questions about that?
Cap, exit narrator, exiting narrator.
Oh, high contrast, right. So let's go back to my app here. If I go back to my first app, and let's say I want to turn on my high contrast. Let's pick white. Okay, so you can see all my high contrast themes here. If I pick the white high contrast theme, just for grins, because the black high contrast theme is probably very similar to your out-of-the-box theme that you already have. So I'm using something that's very different. So here, if I run my app, let's see what happens. You can see, hey, what happened to my string at the top? It just kind of blended into the background. Well, that's because my main page was using a hard-coded color for the text box, right? Get rid of that hard-coded color. Run it now. And it works fine, right? If I change back to the dark theme, this will work correctly. So be careful with that. If you have these hard-coded colors, this will definitely show up when you switch between the different themes. All right? Any questions about accessibility? Got a question back there, sorry. Right, so the question is, how do you change your colors, right? You want to have some colors in your app, but you want to be able to support these high contrast themes. The trick is to change the theme itself. So there's definitely these style files, and it has specific themes. I would change it in there and not in your XAML. If you do it in your XAML, then it's really hard-coded. It won't be able to detect, okay? Question over here? Yes.
Do you also consider testing with different light incentives, day incentives? I mean, in the dark light or sunlight?
Hmm. So the question is, do we test using different light, ambient light,
yes,
around the device? I haven't tried that. But that, I think that may be valid. I would say give it a try. I don't think we tested that in our app. But that's good feedback. Thanks. All right. So that was the high contrast. Right? All right. The last piece of guidance here is to test your app against the UX guidelines, right? This is more motherhood and apple pie stuff. Read the UX guidelines. This will tell you what the standard experience should be for a standard Windows Store application. It gives you very common usage patterns for your applications. If you vary from this, you may still be able to get your app through the Windows certification process. That may work fine, but you may confuse your users. They may be expecting one thing, and you do something very differently. It's kind of up to you. But just know what the norm is. And if you vary from the norm, so be it. But just know what the norm is, and this is the norm. Also, there is a book. There's a free ebook that's available. I don't have the slide for that ebook, but you may be able to feel free to email me. But there's a new ebook about Microsoft Style that covers a lot of these issues. But know what the standard usage pattern is. We got burned on this several times. For example, we didn't read these docs, and we ran into an issue, for example, where we had a flyout, and we put a form on it, right? The user was entering a lot of data in the form, and they type away. What happens? Well, it's a light dismiss. The form went away. We weren't able to capture the data just because they tapped away. So the common usage is don't put form data in there unless it's really simple, like username and password, right? It doesn't hurt the user to have to enter that in, but if you're having them enter an address or a large form and they tap away, it'll go away and they won't be happy. So take a look at those guidelines. There's lots of good feedback, lots of good information in there. Got a question?
Do you guys use any UX folks on your team to build the wireframes and the visual accounts before you build the application so that you wouldn't have to go back and review your guidelines and have problems with that?
So the question was, did we bring in a UX team? And we absolutely did. We absolutely did. We brought in a great UX team, and we worked with them very closely. And that still wasn't enough. These guidelines change, so it's a little bit of a moving target. And because we're learning. We're learning what it is to have a good Windows, modern Windows experience. So it's a moving target. We work with them very closely. And when we got feedback from the product group, from the certification process, they said, hey, you know what? You need to change a couple things. I said, oh, yeah. We kept evolving it and kept evolving it. So again, if you go out to here, to the AdventureWorks Shopper Reference Implementation, this is our app that we wrote, highly tested. It conforms to the latest standards that we found at the time. So take a look at that as a good example of a really well-tested app. Let me go back a couple slides. So that was this, okay. So top problem areas, I think we've covered everything. Suspend, resume, all the way down to UX guidelines. Any last questions about anything here? No? So,
do you have a service that you use for pre-qualifying apps that are destined for the Windows Store?
Do we have a service for so the question is, do we have a service that helps with pre-qualification? No, we don't, but there are tools, automated tools, that will help you check the certification of your app, and those are available through Visual Studio. You can just I think the app certification toolkit. Does anybody remember what it's called?
Windows application certification.
Right, Windows application certification toolkit. Yeah, you can just run that, and it'll give you some information. It may not cover everything, but it'll cover a lot of things. Right. Again, here's my email: fchung@microsoft.com. Shoot me an email if you have any questions. Any last questions? No? Feel free, please fill out an eval. Let me know how I was doing, and if you find value in these types of sessions, right? I'll let you a minute go early, and thank you very much.